The rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold.
What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and yet lose their soul? I mean, it doesn't, but I don't believe we're dealing with human beings in a conventional sense, because when you're, and I saw this up close, my fellow clergy, they all backed off except one guy who, and when I got fired, he went to bat for me and he lost his job for doing it as well. But all of these other clergy really had lost their capacity to make a personal moral choice that went up against the institution. They had surrendered their own conscience for the sake of this institution, and that's a form of possession. In a very basic sense, these institutions, and when you look at their impact in the world, they're like demonic entities, and they have the power to possess. For any society like ours to function, it needs to traumatize children at a young age in order to make them part of a hierarchical, kind of corporatized, dehumanized society.
You're listening to episode 688 of Unwelcome Guests. What does it profit a man? I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard Reverend Kevin Annett, formerly of the Church of Canada, but who was acrimoniously defrocked in spite of strong support from his parishioners. We shall hear the exact circumstances later on in the show. His testimony will make up the majority of our show this time, but I wanted to inject a note of optimism into the show. I found the last four shows on deep politics to be not only informative and exciting to make, I think it's essential background knowledge. It's helped me to understand my own intuitions, decades-long suspicions, if you like, about the fundamental corrupted and corrupting nature of these institutions, nation states, the economy, the hierarchical, adversarial legal system. I suppose it's been a kind of a look under the hood of the vast machine that's trying to perpetuate the hopelessness. Informative and, I think, essential as that is, it has been, in a sense, pretty depressing, some fairly gruesome stuff we've been looking at. Well, today's episode is not about deep politics, but a lot of the material that Kevin Annett presents is pretty dark. So I thought we should start the show with something inspiring. I was very pleased to be contacted last year by an Unwelcome Guests listener who firstly explained how important my thoughts on moneylessness had been to him, how they'd encouraged him to start off on his own moneyless journey. And he also volunteered. He said, how about reading Mark Boyle's Moneyless Manifesto? And I thought, great stuff, and got on to the author. And he said, yeah, great, let's have an audiobook. So we're going to start the show with a reading by David Pearce of Mark Boyle's Moneyless Man. Now, you may be wondering, who is Mark Boyle? We start with a short word about the author.
Mark Boyle has lived completely without money in England for 2.5 years, an experience which formed the basis for his first book, The Moneyless Man. He is also the founder of Free Economy, justfortheloveofit.org, an alternative economy with local groups across 160 countries. He holds a degree in business and for most of his professional career was involved in the management of organic food companies. Dedication. To the day that humanity walks with humility, connection, and great heart amongst the wild again, and that little inch of each of us that knows there's a story more sublime, more dignified, more glorious than numbers. The Moneyless Manifesto by Mark Boyle. Read by David Pearce. Foreword by Charles Eisenstein. Going into my first conversation with Mark Boyle a year ago, I was feeling a little bit defensive. He probably thinks he is better than the rest of us, I thought. More ethical, more pure, less complicit in the sins of civilization. His very lifestyle was an implied accusation. When we actually began talking, though, I found Mark to be free of sanctimoniousness or self-congratulation. That is why his message resonates with so many people. His evident goodwill, care, and compassion disarms us so that we can take in what he has discovered. Going moneyless is a gateway to connection, intimacy, adventure, and an authentic experience of life. Far from being a path of sacrifice to qualify oneself as good, it is a path of joy and, dare I say it, a path of wealth. One contribution of this book is to open that path to others. Often I hear people preface their thoughts on right livelihood with, "Of course we all have to make money. We have mortgages to service, bills to pay. There is, after all, a cost of living. We take it for granted that we have to pay merely to be alive." What Mark shows is that this assumption is part of an illusion. While we might, for very good reasons, choose to use money, we may not actually have to. To break free of that illusion requires a profound shift in our perceptions, habits, and core beliefs, a shift in our way of being in the world, even in our sense of self. The monetized life is a life that separates people from community and from nature, channeling our interdependency through an anonymous medium. Money promises that, if only we acquire enough of it, we can be independent. We can be independent of the people around us. I don't need their help. I can pay for whatever I need. We can be independent of the nature around us. If the water is polluted, I can buy it in bottles. If the soil is toxic, I can buy organic food from afar. In the worst case, I can afford to move away. Here, then, is another illusion. We cannot actually achieve independence via money. All we can do is transfer our dependence from one place to another, from the people and places around us to money and the distant institutions it associates us with. In fact, we are connected beings, utterly dependent on the rest of life to sustain us. Civilized humanity has denied that dependency for a long time, seeking lordship over nature, transcendence of nature. Money has been a part of that illusion of mastery, but today we are moving into an ecological age, seeking to rejoin the circle of life in all its dimensions, ecological and social. Mark Boyle offers us one way to do this. The circle of life is the circle of the gift. Except in those rare instances of barter, living moneylessly reconnects a person to the immediate experience of giving and receiving, and to the ties that result from that experience. Receiving a gift, one feels gratitude toward the giver, toward the giver's community, or even toward the universe, and with it the desire to give in turn. Giving a gift, one feels a connection as well. A freedom to ask something of and receive from that person, community, or planet. Whereas a money transaction is a closed relationship, over as soon as the money is paid, a gift relationship is open-ended. Gifts create bonds, connections. This, and not some imagined exculpation from the sins of industrial society, is the best reason to live moneylessly. None of this means that living moneyless is the only way to enter the spirit of the gift. After all, money itself can be given as a gift. However, money as we know it is fraught with noxious, disconnecting states of consciousness that are contrary to that spirit. Scarcity, anxiety, grasping, competition. Going moneyless is therefore a shortcut to the spirit of the gift. What about the collective level? Can we build a society on the spirit of the gift, and would this necessarily be a moneyless society? Perhaps so in the long run, but even then we will need some way to circulate various forms of wealth, to coordinate labor over vast social distances, and to direct human creativity toward a common purpose. Money, although increasingly dysfunctional today, is supposed to perform these functions. In a more enlightened society, money would do so while evoking a whole new set of intuitions about wealth, security, and the nature of work, and a different way of being in and relating to the world. Indeed, I and many other theorists are working on how to transform money so that it is no longer the enemy of ecology, sustainability, justice, and abundance. That is why I believe Mark's work has significance beyond merely describing a more joyful, connected way of living. He is also contributing to the psychic groundwork of a new system, even if that system includes something we might call money. The revolution before us is only worth joining if it goes to the depths that Mark has explored, the surrender to the flow of life, the recognition of generosity as a core principle of human nature, the trust that as I give, so shall I receive. It is my hope that this book will deepen its readers' belief in the possibility of such a world. Chapter 1. The Money Delusion. Either you repeat the same conventional doctrines everybody is saying, or else you say something true and it will sound like it's from Neptune. Noam Chomsky. Recently, I was at a dinner party where the paper napkins were printed with the image of a 10-pound note. Oddly serene, disturbingly familiar. The Queen's face stared back at all of us, daring us to wipe our grubby faces on what has become the most sacred of symbols. Not one person did. Each napkin lay as smooth and undisturbed as it was when it was laid out. There is something that feels very wrong about using a 10-pound note, even its image, to wipe icing off your mouth. Take a minute to think about that paragraph, and you will begin to see how absolutely stark raving mad the concept of money is turning us. Had those napkins been the plain white kind that were force-fed with every coffee, burger, cocktail, and slice of lemon drizzle at your Nan's cake sale, the kind that float in the background of every outdoor culinary experience, then I would wager that we wouldn't have thought twice about using it once before throwing it away. We are only too happy to churn a countless number of trees through our convenience food sector, yet we hesitate at wiping our face with something with the mere image of a 10-pound note. Money, that soulless, empty, arbitrary concept, subject to the fickle whims of markets and inflation, in itself good for neither feeding us, sheltering us, nor loving us, has become more meaningful, more valued, and more sacred in our lives than trees, providers of oxygen, water, food, shade, shelter, and soil structure. We are in Alice's Wonderland, where nothing is what it seems, and nothing is as it should be. We are completely delusional about what we need in order to live nourished, meaningful lives, and our delusion is destroying not only our ability to do that, but the ability of every other species on the planet to do so too. As the Cree Indian proverb goes, it seems that only when the last tree has died, the last river been poisoned, and the last fish been caught, will we realize we cannot eat money. Considering its power over us, you would wonder why, in 2008, I decided to abandon that course of action and try something different. When I originally decided to start living without money, or, as I prefer to call it, to start living with the types of local gift economy that I will examine in Chapter 2, I did so on the basis of one major realization. Much of the suffering and destruction in the world, factory farms, sweatshops, deforestation, species extinction, resource depletion, annihilation of indigenous peoples and their cultures, were symptoms of a much deeper issue. From what I could see, only a people desperately unaware of their own intimate connection with the rest of life on this planet could behave in the ways we do, and only a people surrounded by powerful distractions could not feel the deep scars that this behavior was causing. Not only was money enabling us to remain shielded from the horrors resulting directly from our consumption habits, it was also the most powerful distraction of all. As time afforded me ever more experiences and lessons in living beyond money, the reasons for doing so took on an almost infinite scale. Embedded in the use of money are distractions and disconnections that I could not have imagined. The list is endless, and I could not include them all here. In the following pages, I have picked out what I feel are the most important points, looking at the consequences of money on our physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual selves, and the subsequent effects on the state of our money and our planet. What it all seemed to boil down to, however, was one simple point. Living without money changed my way of being. Existing outside the monetary economy enabled me to sit inside the organic flow of life and recognize the interconnected oneness. It enabled me to experience a different sense of self. We are here to awaken from our illusion of separateness. Thich Nhat Hanh.
He made bits of metal with his picture on them and said, buddy, if you work for these, you can buy back some of the world God made, and you can have some fruit from off his tree. God made man, man made money, money made man mad. God made man.
The Moneyless Manifesto by Mark Boyle. Live well. Live rich. Live free. Imagine an evening. The stars are high in an ink-black sky, and you are sitting watching logs burn slowly on a campfire. You feel nothing except warmth. Suddenly, a young woman casually begins setting fire to a thick wad of 20-pound notes above it, one by one. Emotions, like the spring sap, surge through you. Indignation. An uncontrollable urge to physically stop her. Utter bewilderment. The thought of all the useful things you could have done with those thin paper sheets, perhaps. Burning logs, burning paper. Why do the two acts invoke such vastly different emotional reactions when, on a fundamental level, we are incinerating the same thing? The only significant distinction is that one wears a symbol. Because of a little symbol, and the cultural stories underlying it, people either live luxuriously or starve. Forests stand proud or are clear-cut. Oceans are left abundant with life or have their bottoms trawled. For reasons that have long since become obsolete, this is the power we have granted the story of money. Introduction. Rather than love, than money, than fame, give me truth. Henry David Thoreau. We were crunching our way through the fresh January snow one blue-skied afternoon, my little hand in hers, when my mom gently told me that Santa Claus wasn't real. She was being kind, of course. A pinch of tough love to save me the ignominy of telling the more streetwise kids what he had brought me that Christmas. But I was 7 and a half, and I had already begun questioning the credibility of this rather portly gift economist for myself. My suspicions kicked in when I was about 4. Up until then, Santa gave to me unconditionally, just like my own mother's breast had once done, regardless of whether I was naughty or nice. As my 5th Christmas approached, I remember being told that things weren't so easy with the big guy after all, and that I wasn't deserving of his kindness any longer unless I was a good boy. Santa's love and life with him seemed to be slowly turning conditional. But us little kids knew that conditionality was not the way of nature. The bramble never asked me if I was naughty before giving me its blackberries, nor the stream its water. So I smelt a rat. Yet voicing such doubts, I feared, could have resulted in a sudden drought of new toys. So for 2 and a half years, I blanked out the thoughts, shut up, and went along with the fanciful story. Little kids can be cunning, too. Despite my strong suspicions, I remember experiencing various emotions as Mom confirmed my doubts. Most of these feelings manifested as questions. If Santa wasn't real, but just a myth that all us kids believed, or chose to go along with because we perceived some benefit from it, then where on earth did all the toys under our noble fir tree come from? Who made them if not his little helpers? Feelings of hurt quickly abounded. Why did those I loved lie to me for so many years? Why did they believe that telling me that some strange, fictional entity had brought me the toys would serve me better than telling me the truth? That those I loved had given them to me? Was it a case of my parents wanting to give me what many religions believe to be the purest of all gifts, the gift which seeks no gratitude or recognition in the mindset that the only true charity is anonymous? Or had our culture long since twisted this most life-affirming of stories into a gradual lesson in conditionality, an incremental acclimatization to the economic sphere my schooling was already preparing me for? With now being used to accompany me on that lonesome modern journey from the unconditional to the conditional, the precursor to a life where everything I received would be conditional on what I gave in return? A life where I would only give or behave in a certain way if I received something else? Or was it more simple than that? A society of people mindlessly passing down and reliving an old story, one long since manipulated by corporate marketing departments, with little thought about whether this revamped myth was actually serving them well or not any longer? Like all big girls and boys, deep down I wanted to know the truth, as disconcerting as it was. The truth is always better than a story, which is partially why I felt compelled to write this book. The truth I needed to face back then was that Santa Claus wasn't real. He was just a myth we made up, passed down from one generation to another, just like leprechauns, the concepts of good and evil, and the belief that licking goat's testicles is a remedy for impotence. Just like money. It was this last truth I wanted to face up to in my 20s. Believe it or not, the concept of money, that modern numerical manifestation of our ideas about credit and debt, is no less of a story than that of Santa Claus and his previous incarnations. When questioned about the extremity of his decision to live moneylessly, Daniel Suelo, who has been living for over 12 years in the U.S. without a dime, once said, "To say that I live without money isn't saying anything, really. That's like saying I live without belief in Santa Claus." Now, if we lived in a world where everyone believed in Santa Claus, you might think I am stepping out on a limb to live without Santa Claus. Why is the need for money a myth? Take a minute to look around you. Try to find one thing you believe hasn't been provided by money. My guess is you can't. Even if you've grown your own food, I would imagine you'd be thinking, "Well, I paid for the seeds and I paid for my tools." And that is the power we have granted money. We have come to believe that we need it, that we depend on it to survive, that we've designed this impersonal and destructive economy of ours around it only serves to perpetuate such delusions. The cultural narrative that is money has such a powerful grip on our minds today that we have come to believe that we could not possibly ever live without it. Through observing humanity's actions, it would appear that living without clean air, fresh water, and fertile soil is considered a more moderate challenge in comparison. We grown-ups strangely believe that money provides for us when it is actually nature, which includes humans, that does so. That we must rely on money is simply another delusion, given power only by the fact that we collectively agree to believe in it. Even Adam Smith, the father of modern economics, said that all money is a matter of belief. We believe in it because experience has taught us that we can get things in return for it, and every time we enact the various rituals, check signing, credit card purchasing, of this story, we strengthen that belief and its grip on our minds. Fiat currency, money's most common form today, has no intrinsic value to set alongside its use as a medium of exchange, meaning that unless we believe the socio-political, cultural, and economic stories that go with it, it can become almost worthless overnight, as countries who have suffered hyperinflation have miserably realized. If our culture stopped believing the myths that back money, and the converging ecological, social, and financial crises are forcing us to do so, the notes in the bank, which in a fractional reserve system aren't many, would have no more worth than their value as a fire starter, which, believe me, is much less than a piece of birch bark. One myth that backs money is that our bank balances will always be redeemable for goods and services with intrinsic value, such as vegetables or a table. However, in a world where almost all of our natural and social capital has been melted down into numbers, with increasingly less of our physical and cultural assets left to be liquidated, such beliefs must soon be questioned. When the rivers are devoid of salmon and full of pollutants, when the invasion of our forests and oceans is complete, when our topsoil is fully depleted and we've laid desert to much of the earth, all that will be left is cold, dead money, as forewarned by the myth of King Midas so many centuries ago. We will be dead, but very, very rich. Another such myth is that you and I are separate. When the illusion of this myth also fades, and one of the aims of this book is the dissolution of this myth, me charging you for the gifts I bring to the world, gifts, remember, that I have originally been given, is no less daft than me charging a tree for the nitrogen in my urine when I pee under it, and it then invoicing me for the oxygen it produces and supplies to my lungs. Nature, like me, abhors bureaucracy and administration, so it simply gives unconditionally, wastes no energy on accounting and surveillance, and instead gets on with doing what it was born to do. In fact, its monumental efficiency is down to the fact that nothing, not the bacteria, not the birds, not the algae, is keeping count. And we should be thankful for that reality. There are so many million interactions going on in every square inch of soil alone at any given moment that our entire world would collapse if it ever tried to. There is absolutely nothing wrong with stories in themselves as long as they continue to serve us and our habitat well, and we can remember one thing. They are just stories, and we can create better ones if we feel they'd be more appropriate to the world we are confronted with. If believing in the myths of Santa Claus or money or licking goats' testicles helps us live more fulfilling, free, and healthy lives in a way that affords the rest of the community of life the same opportunities, then I'm all for it. But if not, would we not be a little wiser to start creating new cultural stories that serve us better? At this point, you're probably thinking that money has actually served us well thus far. It has facilitated the civilization we have before us today, the televisions, the cars, the World Wide Web. Yet how many of us feel utterly enslaved by it, always feeling that we need a little more of it to survive, be happy, or feel successful? As I once read on the back of a toilet door, freedom disappears under the dominance of a bad habit. What if the cultural stories, such as the narrative of the separate self, which I'll be exploring throughout this book, that give rise to money in the first place, turned out to be based on nothing less than the destructive delusions of humanity? What if you realized that the very concept of money, despite its supposedly functional beginnings, would inevitably lead to the Earth and its biosphere becoming uninhabitable for humans and many other life forms in the process? Would you continue to go along with such a destructive story? Or would you want to create a new one? A story that worked for your age and for the unique challenges that your people faced? Throughout this book, I am going to question the myths that laid the foundations to the birth of money, to highlight the damaging consequences that were inevitable since its very creation, but which only hindsight has made evident, and, most importantly, to ask you to help humanity come up with new stories, different ways of doing things that make sense for the world we're all faced with today.
Soon see how when those in power will be thrown down from off their chairs, and all the banks and guns and tanks will be built down to make plowshares. God made man, man made
a reluctant author. I found that the more I learn in life, the less I know or could ever know. It feels arrogant to write a book that could inadvertently give the impression that I, a man only beginning to fully understand even the most basic parts of himself, have any of the answers to humanity's current conundrums. So it is with a certain degree of reluctance that I write this book. We live in a world of many human cultures, despite the fact that they are being relentlessly homogenized by the cultural hegemony and imperialism that has replaced its more traditional forms and which has become synonymous with globalization. Amongst these, there are myriad subcultures, all existing in relationship with ecologies and social conventions too complex to ever intellectually grasp. We are a collection of ancestries with different spiritual and religious faiths and the deep-rooted stories that come with them. Over millennia, our planet has been sliced up into nations with borders, who have developed their own laws, levels of development, social etiquette, cultural myths, material expectations, gender and sex issues, physical and emotional addictions, microclimates, and financial complexities. Even with such diverse demographic groups, personalities vary widely. The same nation homes both Noam Chomsky and Rupert Murdoch. Yet, despite such vast differences, there is much to unite every one of us. We live on one planet, within one biosphere, and our fates are interdependent. Together, we face a smorgasbord of social, ecological, and economic challenges of a truly epic scale, and we hold in common some of the stories that originated them. These converging crises, which provide us with the most exciting opportunity to reappraise and fundamentally change the way we, in the global West, live for the benefit of all life, have no panacea, with one possible exception: the cultivation of a new attitude and spirit in which to live our lives, a simple changing of the lens through which we perceive the world. While collectively taking off the lens called, "How much can I get?" and putting on another labeled, "How much can I give?" "How many people can I make smile today?" or "How can we work together to nourish and sustain the life around us?" wouldn't by itself cut the Gordian knots of climate chaos, resource depletion, and TV-generated boy bands. It would make for a crucial starting point. Take a moment and think about it. Imagine how our days would feel if we lived our lives with such a fresh outlook and focus. None of us fully understand what lies ahead, but fostering an unconditional commitment to help each other through it all, come what may, is a rather useful prerequisite to any of the more technical solutions. If we can't find a more caring, respectful, fulfilling, and meaningful way to live together, what is the point of existing here anyway? Aside from suggesting such a new and radical life perspective, I certainly lay no claim to having any, let alone all, of the answers to humanity's monumental challenges. It is true that I have a rather peculiar and unique perspective on the world, having made an odd journey from being an overtly consumerist business graduate to someone who lived completely without money for almost 3 years, allowing me the opportunity to experience both perspectives and to see which story most fulfilled me. It turned out to be a life-altering endeavor, yet it made me realize that there is no one global answer. And the logic behind thinking that there might be is precisely the same logic that got us into this mess in the first place. The answers to the challenges we face must be localized, and stories must be tailored to meet the needs of the people in each unique land base. That said, in the coming chapters, I would like to do two things. I aim to dive deep into what I believe to be one of the root causes of many of our seemingly unsolvable predicaments and explore one of the myths that has led us to this pivotal point in human history, a myth that almost the entirety of the world's cultures, nations, and faiths now buy into, perhaps the most omnipresent tale in the history of our species. By suggesting possible solutions to the challenges that await us, I aim only to encourage you to recognize that the monetary economy is not the only type of economy we can choose, and to consider whether or not other economic models are needed for the unique period of human history we are facing. This is no longer 16,000 BC after all, so why should we continue mindlessly perpetuating rituals which grew from cultural myths that were relevant and useful for that stage in our evolution, but arguably are not so appropriate for us now? Regardless of whether you love money or hate it, its benefits are widely recognized, and it is undoubtedly one of the most revolutionary concepts we've ever devised, having provided a framework for all the subsequent revolutionary change that has shaped today's world. What I feel is entirely lacking, however, is a deeper awareness and understanding of what the full consequences of money are on us personally, socially, and ecologically. One of my aims will be to explain why I believe humanity needs to move beyond the tale of money and its underlying mindset of formal exchange if we are to have a long-term future worth having on this planet. This book's raison d'etre certainly isn't just to explain the reasons I believe we need to re-examine our relationship with money. Its ultimate goal is to provide you with a comprehensive menu of ways through which you can meet your needs without money, or at least become less dependent on it. Ways that allow you a lot more control over your life and as much creativity as you can handle. How you can limit your negative and increase your positive impact on the rest of nature and your own community. How to free yourself up from a job you are not enjoying anymore. Or simply pathways to parts of yourself you didn't even know existed. We all have our own reasons for wanting to reduce our dependency on money, or to simply spend less of it. My own initial and very personal reason was to reconnect with my land base and the people and creatures I shared it with, as I strongly believe that until we reconnect in those ways, true sustainability and non-exploitative ways of living will simply remain something we talk about at posh conferences over coffee. Now my reasons for moving beyond the monetary economy seem to grow by the day, and I will explore these in the next chapter. I also realized I wanted to live in freedom, in a way that afforded the rest of the life I share the planet with that simple opportunity. Freedom and happiness, one at the expense of that of another, is not the freedom and happiness I want. For many people I know, their reason is more urgent and less highfalutin. They no longer have a job. The large negative equity on their mortgaged homes means that they are unable to move somewhere that has available employment. Others simply want to live outside of the system and take back some of the freedom they feel is being incrementally stolen from them. More still are outraged at the privatization of the money creation process, whilst some are getting ready for both financial and ecological apocalyptic scenarios. These are all mostly practical reasons, but just as many people tell me, they strive toward moneylessness for their own private spiritual reasons. None of these reasons for questioning our relationship with money are more right or wrong than the others, and they are all valid. This liquid tool, one that ought to exist to serve us, has stealthily become our master instead, harming us on many levels, each of us in different ways. It is my opinion that it may have already served its useful time here, having already brought us to a point in our collective evolution where we can now decide to start moving beyond the monetary economy and into a localized gift economy, which I will describe in Chapter 2.
Deep down in every one of us, we hope for a world where justice, truth, and kindness prevail. Well, we can work towards it right now if we let love be our motivation for everything that we do. Thank you.
there be an end to dishonesty? Everyone will speak truth with their neighbor with love. Becomes our philosophy. There be an end to hypocrisy. Our love will shine through our behavior with love. Becomes our philosophy. Becomes our philosophy. Becomes our philosophy. Picture a world when all children are starving, 'cause everybody shares their bread. Picture a world without any money, where people work for love instead. You and I, we can make it happen if we make today become the day when love becomes our philosophy. There'll be an end to dishonesty. Everyone will speak truth with their neighbor. When love becomes our philosophy, there'll be an end to hypocrisy. Our love will shine through our behavior. When love becomes our philosophy, becomes our philosophy.
That was When Love Becomes Our Philosophy by the Jesus Christians, who also produced Money Made Man Mad, from which we heard a couple of snatches earlier. Now, for our main feature this episode, this is former minister Reverend Kevin Annett from Canada, whom Wikipedia, by the way, deems as non-notable because he's been blacklisted by the commercially controlled media. So his page has been removed on at least two occasions. And this is an interview by Spectrum Radio Network, which was posted in November 2011.
Hello, we're talking to Kevin Annett, who did the film Unrepentant. Kevin Annett, the Canadian genocide. And he'll be telling us about what he's done. Now, that movie was about 4 years ago.
That's right, 2007, around January, released it.
Okay. I'm curious to know, well, first of all, what we always usually cover is the history. So what, in a bullet point, what got you to that point of making a documentary? Because I'm sure there's a lot to it.
Well, the reason the documentary was made was because there was a need at the time to tell my story, because really I had been the only one since 1996 documenting these crimes in the residential schools. And that same year, the government apologized for the first time for these crimes, and it was talked about in Parliament. But the reason it was apologized for was because of all the work we've been doing publicly. So we felt there was a need to tell the history that had led to that. And also to show the story from the point of view of an establishment white guy, because most white people aren't going to relate to the story if it's just about Indians. That's a kind of the hard reality. So we were trying to reach more of the mainstream with the film. That was kind of the philosophy behind it.
Okay. What have been the ramifications of making the documentary?
Well, in a nutshell, we forced the issue onto the stage in Canada. An example of that is the member of parliament who stood up for the first time and asked the question, when are these children going to be brought home for proper burial? Gary Murasty, he had watched our film. He was a native MP from Saskatchewan. And all of his constituents were saying, you better do something about this. You know, there's graves all over the country. So he stood up, and after that, within a few weeks of him asking that question in parliament, they had announced their so-called Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the apology was formulated, and, you know, they even talked about forming a missing children's task force, although that never happened. But it shows you, you know, the power of just getting this out. We didn't do it in a professional manner. We just did the basic facts and stuck it up on our internet and on Google. And within a year, there were 500,000 hits. So,
right.
You know.
Definitely a pretty impactful film. I seen it about 4 years ago, when it first came up. And amazing film. Absolutely amazing. But just for those people who have not seen the film and are wondering what we're talking about, what exactly are we talking about?
We're talking two things. The history of planned genocide in Canada, where over 50,000 children died in state and church-run Indian boarding schools between about 1890 and 1996, when the last one was closed. We're also talking about my story of how I discovered this as a United Church minister, how I was eventually thrown out of the church for bringing forward these stories, and trying to show how really the stories are intertwined, just like the story of whites and Indians in Canada are very connected, kind of a microcosm of that, of what had happened that you know, to lead to this final exposure of these crimes.
And what were some of the crimes, just for detail purposes?
Well, I mean, they're everything that is described under international law as genocide. We're talking about outright killings of children, putting them in conditions where they were starving every day, they were receiving no education, rampant torture, regular gang rape by staff, medical experimentation, sterilization programs, where any Indian who wouldn't go to church was targeted for sterilization. All of these things, you know.
So a little bit of mind control as well.
Absolutely. And Native people were used, especially in the 1950s and 60s, for MKUltra. Experiments in Montreal, here in Ontario, all across the West, and in Indian hospitals where these sterilizations and other things were going on. We had access to those records until right after our first tribunal in 1998. The government suddenly closed, officially sealed all the records of the Indian hospitals. You can't access them anymore without security clearance. So it shows you that they're definitely hiding a lot of stuff related to what they're doing in these places.
And you can't get anything through the Freedom of Information?
No, there's certain things that they will not allow public access to, and now the Indian hospital records require an application to Prime Minister's office. I tried going to the National Archives in Ottawa this last year, and the librarian said you can't see that stuff anymore.
Sure, but that's meeting. Against the law of access, huh?
Well, there's matters that they don't let access to if it's considered national security. No, don't forget that's a military term, and a lot of these hospitals and experiments were being run under the auspices of the military in conjunction with the U.S. military. So that's one of the reasons that, you know, they're not letting them in.
That's true. They can sweep it under that rug because it was part of the American and Canadian MKUltra program that had military funding that was using universities and professors from universities who had assigned the security acts, so they wouldn't really reveal any of that information. And those are 25-year, signed on the dotted line. I won't say anything for 25 years. They're pretty much locked down.
Well, and these were heavily funded by the CIA. That's all been proved now as part of their program.
Sure.
So Indian kids were an easy group to access. It wasn't Indians only.
No, of course.
But they were certainly targeted. Yeah.
They were targeted. They were part of a target group.
Yeah.
One of many target groups. Now, didn't they also try to limit them or stop them from practicing their belief system, the Indian belief system, as well as speak their language?
Well, that was implicit right from the very beginning. Just a little bit of history. During about a 10-year period in the 1880s, when the Canadian Pacific Railway finally linked the country, the Indian Act, Indian reservation systems, the residential schools were all created, and the RCMP were created as a national paramilitary police force whose main mandate was to clear off all the Indians within 50 miles of the railway to allow white settlement very rapidly. Now, in the West, that's where most of the residential schools were located. These aren't schools, first of all, remember. That's a term the government created as mind fog. These were internment camps where the deliberate strategy was to separate take the young generation of natives and kill off at least half of them, depopulate the areas that were target for, you know, settlement and resource extraction and things like that. Then take the remnant and turn them into a brainwashed aboriginal group. Now, aboriginal means not of the original group. So you have a different mindset. You've had the mind of the colonial conqueror put in your head. And when you look at the so-called native political leadership these days, you can see what the end result of that was. People who have lost their traditions and their language, they see themselves as part of Canada. They don't see, like the Mohawk people around here, the traditionalists say, we've never been part of Canada. This is Ogwahanwin land, the land of the true people, as they call it. And they don't recognize the jurisdiction of Canada here. But most native leaders are on the government payroll. They've been the main ones who have opposed any investigation into the deaths of their own relatives in the residential schools. So only a brainwashed population would think in those terms or operate like that. And that was the purpose of the the camps, the Christian internment camps, if you like. Mm-hmm. They were a massive mind control experiment. And implicit in that was you were tortured and killed if you spoke your own language. You know, if you identify in any way with your culture, if you tried to get home, the RCMP would chase you down and bring you back, usually punishment that often resulted in death. This is happening. I mean, to give you one example of this, I was speaking to a woman today who told one story of what happened right here in Brantford. This is the oldest residential school right here in Brantford,
really?
Set up by the Church of England in 1832, closed in 1970. So the Queen is directly responsible as head of state for what happened here. This one woman, Lorna McDonald, said that she watched while a little girl was drowned in a bucket of water. Her face was kept down in a bucket of water. At other times, the kids were forced to stand together and given electric shocks twice a month, just random torture. And there were other tales of kids. There's even a story, Lorna came on the radio 2 weeks ago and said that her brother Rufus saw Canadian soldiers take out children from the school in 1943 and shoot them and put them in a ditch about a mile from here in what's called the Glebe site. Now, we've gone over there and looked at that site. We've done test digs, and we found human remains. A local archaeologist has identified these as children's bones mixed in with potash, which was used back then to dissolve bodies. So there's direct evidence now that there was a mass grave here, and it was a result of killings. Now, this is the first time in Canada we've documented that kind of story, but where there's smoke, there's fire. And we're going to hope that other groups are going to be wanting to do the excavations to other native groups.
If more people come to you and tell you stories, they can give you clues as to where the next place is to look. Now, just to be clear, this is in Brantford, Ontario, Canada, where we are right now.
Yeah.
And you've been going to these sites just over the last couple of days. Is this what you've been doing the last couple of days?
Well, it actually started, I came here 4 years ago.
Okay.
I've been giving talks and meeting people here. And what's good about the Mohawks here of the Grand River is for years they've been fighting to preserve their dwindling land base. They were originally given 1 million acres around here under what's called the Haldimand Treaty because they sided with the British in the Revolutionary War in the States. And then after the generals Washington and Clinton drove the Mohawks out of New York, they settled here. The British gave them this land that they said would be theirs until the end of time. Well, of the 1 million acres, there's only 30,000 left, about 3% of the land base. So their fight all the time to preserve their land. They stand in front of tractors and bulldozers. There's been a big land reclamation movement here. Those very same people are the ones who invited me in. Back in April, I got a letter from the 9 of the elders here, asking me to come and do investigations, including archaeological digs on this site, in order to take that evidence, help repatriate the children's remains for a proper burial, and then take that evidence to Europe to human rights investigations so that we can charge Canada and the Church of England, the Catholics, the the United Church for, with crimes against humanity. So this has been a long process, but we're beginning it. We're commencing digs this week.
Now, just to be clear,
yeah,
they went from how much land? Over a million?
Over a million acres to less than 30,000 now.
To 30,000?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
And it's shrinking every day. There's, this week, there, some of the elders are going out to stand at just down the road here where they're trying to build a hotel on their land. They go in, they don't ask the Mohawk people at all, they just start building on the land. And unless they're confronted physically, they just go ahead because the law is all on the side of
right. Yeah, but Canadian
whites.
You know, land claim, we have paperwork we have to fill out, you know? So how could they possibly just go and...
How could they have set up schools where 50,000 children die? I mean, they do it because under the law, Indians aren't citizens. Under the Indian Act, you're a ward of the state. So if you live on reservation, which you have to if you want to get government money, you're not a citizen. You're in the same legal category as a child or a mentally incompetent person. You can't do anything without Ottawa's approval.
Right.
So they can do anything they want. The Crown, in the Indian Act, the first words are, all land is vested in the Crown. And that's true anywhere in Canada.
Yeah,
6 months or 6 inches of the soil can be owned by you, but beneath 6 inches, it's all Crown land, all the resources. It, traditionally, that was the depth of a plow. Mm. So they could let us be farmers to till the earth, but we don't actually own it. Mm. Only the Crown does. So it's this huge corporation that's responsible for this genocide and is responsible for keeping us all paupers in our own land. And, you know, indebted slaves, if you like, right? So it's the same, I think it's the same genocide. It's always been about the land.
Yeah, land, resources,
yep.
Space, whatever. You know, they just want more area.
Yep.
And the building's continuing, you know. They're spreading out and they're encroaching upon what little land they did give them.
Yep.
Like they have the right to give land, or take it for that matter. Mm-hmm. So what are the complaints nowadays? What's the current issues? Because a lot of what you were talking about in the documentary, I would think that what you're seeing now is just more of the same, or are there, you know, it's more widespread than what you originally found out.
Yeah, well, there's two things. There's the crimes that have happened and the crimes that are still going on. And that's why I call my book Hidden No Longer, Genocide in Canada, Past and Present. And this has got all the evidence that I've accumulated over 15 years. It's at hiddennolonger.com.
And we'll have a link to that
right
on our website in the upcoming guest section.
Yep.
The day after the show, it will be in the past guest section.
Yep.
So if anybody wants to go that, they can order it.
Well, let me give you an example of this. In the book, in terms of past crimes, here's a chart that was done by Dr. Peter Bryce, who is a government, he was the top medical officer for the Ontario government, and he went out on a tour of all the Western residential schools twice, in 1907 and 1909, and he found that half the children were dying regularly in every school. Because of there's a figure right there describing half the children dead in one Alberta residential school, the blood reserve.
Half of them.
Half of them. And according to this, 38 were alive and 36 were dead. Now, the reason Dr. Bryce said that was happening is because of a practice deliberately housing children who are healthy with the sick and dying, and then allowing, never treating them. So they
right.
died en masse. And that happened over 50 years. So, you know, when the government and the churches now pretend that these children just died because of lack of funding, it wasn't intentional, it was just, you know, kind of an accident almost. They have to answer the question, how come that went on for 50 years then, if it was just a matter of underfunding? I mean, clearly there was an intent. It doesn't go on for that long unless it was intentional. Another piece of evidence about that, here's a copy of an order in council from 1919 abolishing medical inspection in the residential schools. After the report had come out,